It's something we don't like to talk about, but cancer is all around us. It would be hard to find someone who hasn't been touched by cancer. Not just someone you know, but someone you love.
I've done this because I lost my mother and two brothers to cancer.
I basically shut down. Like, I was totally blown apart and terrified.
From Michigan Radio, this is Living with Cancer. I'm Rebecca Williams. Cancer is a part of us. It starts in our DNA and grows in our cells.
It's not just tobacco smoke, but walking out in the sun causes the same kind of thing. It causes damage to genes. So how come we all don't have cancer if that's the case?
For the next hour, we'll be exploring the ways that our environment can set that process in motion.
If children are getting cancer, you know there's something wrong. There's something wrong.
That healing is as much a spiritual and social thing as it is a medical thing.
First, this news.
My name is Jill Gleason. I was just going to talk about my partner, Melissa. She died on December 29th of this past year after having survived a long struggle, about 2.5 years of cancer. And I'd been wanting to think about, I'd been thinking about wanting to talk about cancer more with people. There's no, like, guidebook. There's no handbook on how to talk about these things. We used to joke about that we used to get a lot of lasagnas because nobody knew what to do for us. So at one point we had like 6 lasagnas in the freezer. Like, it was hard. She's a private person. She was a private person. She didn't want to talk about cancer with everybody. And that was really hard for a lot of people to understand. And it's so, you know, I had to negotiate who she saw. And sometimes I'd have to have conversations with people before they came over to kind of tell them, hey, this is what she needs. And if you can't do that, then I'm going to have to interrupt you and make you leave. You know, I didn't want to be the person who was keeping their sister and friend away from them. But I had to do what she wanted. It'd be better if we had conversations about death without death being present, without somebody having to die. She probably would have laughed and be like, oh, stop talking about me. But it helps. It helps, even though it stinks.
Death and grief can be difficult, sometimes painful to talk about. These are things that often come with cancer. But so do stories of survival and determination. From Michigan Radio, this is Living with Cancer. I'm Rebecca Williams. Everyone's experience with cancer is different. Throughout the hour, we'll be hearing more of these personal stories. But first, we trace cancer back to its beginning in order to figure out what makes our cells turn cancerous. There are more than 100 different kinds of cancer, each with different personalities and causes. Reporter Mark Brush has been looking into some of those causes. So, Mark, what did you learn about where cancer comes from?
Well, it's really hard to know on a case-by-case basis exactly where cancer comes from, but that is one of the first questions people ask, you know, when they get the diagnosis is, you know, where did this come from?
Right. Is it something I did? Do I have something in my family history? Or was it something that I was exposed to?
Exactly. When I sat down with Corinna Borden about her cancer diagnosis, another big question she had was, you know, why me? About 6 years ago, she woke up in the middle of the night with a pain in her ribcage. It kept getting worse, and it took her doctors months to figure out what it was. It was Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is a type of cancer. When she found out, she pretty much shut down.
Like, I was totally blown apart and terrified, and I couldn't think of anything but that I was going to die, and this was really unfair.
Corinna wondered what happened. Was it something in her family? Was there something in her food? Or something somewhere in her environment that caused her cells to mutate out of control. There are many factors that can lead to cancer. There are the genes we inherit. There are viruses. There are naturally occurring things like sun exposure, arsenic in water, and radon. All these factors can interplay with the cells in our body and lead to cancer. And then there are the man-made chemicals in our lives. How these impact cancer is tough to figure out. The National Toxicology Program lists 240 substances that could lead to cancer. Each year, a panel of scientists appointed by the president takes stock of the nation's strategy to fight cancer. In 2010, a panel appointed by former President George W. Bush issued a report that said, quote, "The true burden of environmentally induced cancer has been grossly underestimated." Dr. LaSalle LaFall chaired the panel. He says only a fraction of the 80,000 chemicals in use today are tested for safety.
The health effects of many of these chemicals have not been studied, or they've been understudied, and the chemicals really remain unregulated.
The panel's report was criticized by the American Cancer Society. They say only about 6% of cancer deaths are caused by occupational exposure and environmental pollutants. And because of that, more focus should be put on the bigger risks, things like smoking, sun exposure, diet, and lack of exercise. Dr. Richard Clapp is an environmental epidemiologist at Boston University. He says the 6% number is outdated. It's a 30-year-old estimate. And he says right now we don't know enough to make a solid estimate.
It's not like environmental and occupational exposures cause, you know, 70% or 80%. We don't know that. Anyone that claims they know that is making it up. There's no way to prove that. But we do know that there are people getting exposed to stuff that causes cancer. Why would we want to have that continue?
Clapp says if there is a chemical out there that looks like it might be linked to cancer, we should just get rid of it. Corinna Borden doesn't know how she got cancer, but she's changed her life now. She got rid of the chemicals in her house, she filters her water, and she changed what she eats. But she says she tries not to be consumed by these choices. She still has to live.
I've been in a position where I didn't want to get out of bed because I was so afraid of dying, and that's not how we should live. Life is precious and beautiful, and I really feel that you need to go out and experience it, and going out and maybe being a little closer to the edge some days is what choice do we have?
So, Rebecca, it's been 6 years since Corinna first got that diagnosis, and her cancer is still with her today. This summer, she just went through another round of chemotherapy in Germany.
Has she figured out what caused her cancer?
No, she hasn't, and that's true for a lot of people. Even though there have been a lot of big advances in cancer screening and treatment, we still don't know for sure what makes our cells turn cancerous in the first place. It's something that researchers are finding out more and more about, but there's still a lot of big mysteries out there.
Okay, thanks, Mark.
You're welcome.
We'll hear more from Mark later in the program. Cancer is a disease that starts with changes in our cells, but how does our environment trigger those changes? Dr. Dean Brenner is the Cucci Family Professor of Internal Medicine and Professor of Pharmacology at the University of Michigan Medical School. He's also an oncologist on the staff of the VA Medical Center in Ann Arbor. He joins us to explain why it's so hard for someone like Corinna to pinpoint the cause of her cancer. Dr. Brenner, welcome.
Thank you.
Why is it so tough to figure out where someone's cancer came from?
Well, cancer isn't one disease. And even within a cancer itself, there is substantial heterogeneity, meaning differences among cells, so that the genes that cause a cell to turn into cancer, even within the same cancer, might differ between cells within a cancer. You can imagine the challenge that creates to anybody who both wants to find out how this happens, why it happens, or wants to try to treat it, to try to either prevent it or try to treat it when it happens.
Okay, so if it's so complicated to figure out why cancer starts on an individual level, is there something that we know about the way cancer works in the cells, how it starts? How does it start?
The development of cancer is most of us believe that cancer develops with multiple inputs. There's an environmental input, and the environmental input could be just our day-to-day exposures. On the other hand, there's clearly a genetic component, meaning that our cells, our genes are programmed in certain ways. We inherit from our parents. And you can imagine the variances that one might have in 9 billion bases. Some of the variances are very minor and they don't cause any problems. But some of them can be fairly important in terms of making a strand or a section of the gene susceptible. For example, why is it that some people can smoke 100 packs a day for 100 years and never get cancer? And other people might smoke one pack a day for 10 years and get a terrible lung cancer. Why? You'd think that if our genes were all kind of similar, is that you'd have a certain threshold of exposure and then you'd all get cancer, right? And that's not the way it is. If they weren't exposed at all, they might never get cancer because the exposure stresses the gene. It stresses the bases. It causes breaks in them. It causes problems in the normal genes. What happens? How do we protect ourselves? It's not just tobacco smoke, but walking out in the sun causes the same kind of thing. It causes damage to genes. So how come we all don't have cancer if that's the case? It's this confluence, it's this interaction between the environmental exposure and the individual genomes that result in the development of the disease. And that's the individualization.
We'll hear more from Dr. Brenner later in the program. Cancer affects all of us. About 41% of us will someday be diagnosed with cancer. Even if you're not part of that 41%, it's likely that someone you know will be. A piano player at the Van Elslander Cancer Center in Detroit, Michigan, knows what it's like to be on both sides of that statistic.
My name is Sylvia Judy Fiondo. We're in the Van Elslander lobby near the reception desk, and I can see everybody who comes in and goes out. We're here so that I can maybe take some of the tension out of the air as they walk in the door, because most of the people here are here for serious reasons, or they're accompanying someone who has serious reasons. I was here because I was a patient here for about a year to go through the surgery, the chemotherapy, and then the radiation. The resolution that I made when I got my diagnosis of cancer was that I wasn't going to spend the rest of my life worrying about when I was going to die. I felt like my life depends on what I want to do with it right now. If I want to let this take over, then I will lose my joy. And that's what I don't want to lose my joy. And it all turned out all right, and I don't think it was my positive thinking. I had good doctors. I had a lot of support. I had everything that I needed to get better. And I realized that this cancer, any cancer, maybe, is never cured. It's in remission. And so if that happens again, I'll face it again. But look, I've had almost 10 years. It'll be 10 years this October.
That was Sylvia Judy Fiondo. She's a piano player at the Van Elslander Cancer Center in Detroit. Coming up, what would you do if you had only 1 year to live?
We decided to cash in our 401ks and hit the road. That's what we did. We took all of our money and blew it. We spent all of it. If there was a quarter in the couch, we bought something.
That story in 15 minutes on Living with Cancer from Michigan Radio. From Michigan Radio, this is Living with Cancer. I'm Rebecca Williams. There's been so much cancer among Karen Hawk's relatives that she calls it the family disease. It's been following her around for over 40 years. Her dad died from leukemia in the 60s, and she was diagnosed with lymphoma twice. The first time in seminary school, then again 23 years later.
My dad had leukemia in 1960, and it was at a time when there was very little they could do for that. Now, my dad wanted to know about it. My mom didn't want to talk about it, but he did. In fact, she didn't even want to tell him that he had cancer. In those days, patients would get diagnoses and nobody would tell them what it was. My grandmother, my mother's mother, got cancer the next summer, and my mother never told her. Never. My family likes to be quiet about things, you see, and not talk about them, and I couldn't. I just couldn't respond that way. I was diagnosed in 1981 with, my dad had leukemia, I had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. They did a regimen called MOP therapy, which is a combination of four different drugs. And one time when the first nurse did it, she put it in my arm, and it was so toxic, it ate the vein as it went up. It turned it black. There was a big black line on my arm. It was very painful. The treatment made me really sick, nauseated and such. So I was really angry. First of all, I was in seminary, and so what is this? God's calling me to seminary, and then I'm getting cancer? I don't get this. When they finally say that you're in remission, and that's what they say, they don't say you're cured. They say you're in remission and you need to be monitored for 5 years. And I guess then they said, you know, you're cured. So that was when I was in Boston, and I moved to Middletown, Ohio, and they found it. Non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So the treatment was very similar, but in the 23 years that intervened, they had learned a lot more. You know, the support was so powerful. I had letters from people all over the world because I had classmates in seminary who had disseminated all over the world, and they heard. And I know the doctors do part of it, but they don't do all of it. That healing is as much a spiritual and social thing as it is a medical thing.
Karen Hawk's cancer is in remission. The experience of being a cancer patient doesn't end in the hospital. Treatments can go on for months or years, and cancer has a way of getting into every corner of our lives, not just our bodies. The way we respond to cancer's presence in our culture has changed a lot over time. Dr. Dean Brenner joins us again to talk about some of those changes and about some of the things we still don't know about how cancer works. Dr. Brenner, how has the way that we talk about cancer changed in the last 40 or 50 years?
Well, when I started in the field in the late 70s, cancer was just coming out of the closet. But the history is so fascinating because it was actually a strategic thing to make it more into a public issue. There was a push to obtain public support to develop new therapies and so that we could cure cancer. And that was the War on Cancer, 1971, that act that was passed and signed by President Nixon. So in the late 60s and early 70s, there was a large push to inform the public. And from then on, I think that cancer became very different. It became a household thing almost for people. It was no longer taboo.
So we're talking about cancer a lot more openly than we used to. But there's still a lot we don't know. Where are the dark corners of our understanding about cancer?
Well, I think that with a disease, with a process perhaps of this complexity, there's lots we don't know and lots of challenges. The first real issue, I think, is what I call risk assessment. The who is at risk, and how do we quantify that, and then how do we inform people of that, and how do we counsel them? I'd say another challenge is what you mentioned at the beginning of this current discussion. How do we inform and how do we guide and support family members and other people and families about their loved ones' cancers, and how do we help people who have been treated successfully? I think that's a dark corner in a way. I think we've not been effective there, and we don't understand how to even intervene and to provide care to an increasing number of cancer survivors, and how do we manage the side effects, the long-term side effects from the cancer.
So we've been talking about finding a cure for cancer for many years, but while science has gotten closer to a more refined understanding of cancer, we still haven't broken through to a solution. Do you think we will ever find a cure?
Some cancers we cure now, and we cure them very well. I think that there'll be a lot of them that we will identify that aren't of great risk, even if you have them. And there'll be others that we're going to cure with the newer approaches of finding out, understanding the heterogeneity biologically, and then fixing those biological problems. And there'll be some that we're able to cure and be able to cure with current cytotoxic approaches and hormonal approaches. So again, the single cure is not something that we can really talk about. What we can talk about is a very huge number of problems. I mean, thousands, millions maybe of different types of cancers where we are able to individualize and able to obtain solutions to the great majority of them. And I think that's the future.
Dr. Dean Brenner is the Cucci Family Professor of Internal Medicine and Professor of Pharmacology at the University of Michigan Medical School. He's also an oncologist on the staff of the VA Medical Center in Ann Arbor. Dr. Brenner, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me.
We can't alter our DNA or change the composition of our cells. That's why it's so tempting to turn to the environment for answers. We can control some of the things we're exposed to, though the connection between cancer and the environment is not always clear. But cancer leaves clues. If a lot of people in one place start getting sick, it might be caused by something in the environment, something they're all exposed to. The term cancer cluster describes a place like that, a place where more people have cancer than you would expect. But finding out if a cluster really exists and then getting something done about it is tough. Reporter Sarah Alvarez visited one town in Michigan that's trying to figure that out.
Claire Schlaff doesn't know if there's a cancer cluster in her small resort community around White Lake, Michigan. She says she just wanted to know more about what might have caused her son, Doug, to get cancer and die 3 years ago.
He went to two major medical facilities, and he was even in a clinical trial. You know, they were focused on his treatment. They weren't about doing research into what causes Ewing sarcoma.
Claire's daughter-in-law, Polly, was also looking for answers to what had caused the disease. She's Doug's widow and the mother of his three boys.
He was diagnosed when he was 33, and he passed away at 35. We were high school sweethearts. He was a high school counselor. He was a high school basketball coach. He was an athlete.
Polly and Claire had a hunch that there was more cancer around White Lake than in other places, so they started a Facebook group called Cancer in White Lake. They collected more than 100 stories from people with all types of different cancers. Claire thought it might have something to do with past pollution.
In 1985, we were listed as one of the Great Lakes areas of concern because of contamination from Hooker Chemical, the tannery, DuPont, and maybe some others.
White Lake has been cleaned up. It's expected to come off the list of polluted places this year. The local health department doesn't have any data to show there's more cancer around White Lake than any place else. But Claire and Polly and some dedicated volunteers want to get the health department more data. The state keeps track of cancer rates by county, but not by town. And there are lots of types of cancers that they don't keep track of at all. So Claire and Polly turn their Facebook group into something else.
It's a voluntary, self-reporting mapping project.
They're trying to map all the people in their community who've had cancer in hope of getting their health department interested in looking into it. They're finding, then calling, and surveying about 1,000 people. Terry Nordbrock runs the nonprofit National Disease Cluster Alliance.
There's hundreds and hundreds of times where people have a concern, they're observing, you know, harmful effects in their community, and they can't get anybody to listen to them. So that is actually the more common outcome is massive frustration for all involved.
Claire Schlaff says she doesn't expect answers about what caused her son's cancer. She does hope her work is useful and can provide answers for somebody someday.
We'll hear more from Sarah in a little while. The state of Michigan has confirmed a cancer cluster in St. Clair County. Since 2007, 8 young children, and a possible 9th, have been diagnosed with a rare kidney cancer called Wilms tumor. Danielle Williams' daughter, Erica, was the first to be diagnosed. She was 7 years old.
My daughter was playing soccer, and she came home that night, and we noticed that she had a protruding lump on the side of her belly. And to the touch, it was hot.
An ultrasound revealed what looked like a 6-inch mass in Erica's kidney. Erica had surgery to remove her left kidney, and that's when the doctors discovered the tumor was the size of a football.
In the hospital, she quit. She didn't speak. She didn't really know what was going on, but she knew it was serious because they're so little. You know, they don't know the serious of it. But her seeing me so broken, she sat there in silence all the time, didn't talk.
Danielle says after Erica's surgery, she went through radiation and a year of chemotherapy. Erica is in remission now. Officials with the Centers for Disease Control say more than 90% of kids diagnosed with Wilms tumor survive. A few months after Erica's diagnosis, another child in the county was diagnosed with Wilms tumor. And then more kids got sick. The youngest was a six-month-old baby girl.
If children are getting cancer, you know there's something wrong. There's something wrong.
Danielle lives in Marine City on the St. Clair River. It's downstream from Sarnia, Ontario. That area is nicknamed Chemical Valley because of the complex of petrochemical plants on the river. There have been hundreds of spills in the past two decades. Several cities, including Marine City, pull their drinking water from the river. Danielle suspects something in the water or the air is making the kids sick. But health officials say right now there is no clear connection between any environmental factor and Wilms tumor. Tom Sinks is with the CDC's National Center for Environmental Health. He says it's believed Wilms tumor could stem from something that happens before a baby is born.
So if you translate that into doing an epidemiologic study, you have to try to recreate what environmental exposures or what the conditions may have been for the mother during pregnancy or possibly before pregnancy.
The St. Clair County Health Department has been following the Wilms cases for a few years. Dr. Annette Mercatant is the medical health officer with the health department. They've given the families in the cancer cluster a detailed survey.
You know, where did they live? What did they eat? Their medical history, their work exposure history. We're just going to be trying to be very comprehensive.
They're also going to try to track down the placentas of the children. Hospitals often save placentas when babies are born. There's a research team at the University of Michigan that's hoping to study the placental tissue to see if they can find any clues about the Wilms tumor cluster. Dr. Mercatant says it will be difficult to figure out why these kids are getting sick.
I need to be honest. And the honest answer is we don't know, and we very well may not know for a long time to come, if ever, especially in something as rare as this.
But she says this cluster of children with cancer deserves a very close look. Fourteen months after they were married, Amy Scott's husband, Joe White, was diagnosed with esophageal cancer. Doctors tried to treat it, but nothing worked.
When they say you have cancer, or in our case, you have terminal cancer, and you only have about a year, all of these things that you would that bog you down in life, those are suddenly gone. And that's what the gift of cancer is. It's complete release from obligations that are a part of life that when you live a long life, you have to obey. But when you have a very short life, it's freedom. We decided to cash in our 401ks and hit the road. That's what we did. We took all of our money and blew it. We spent all of it. If there was a quarter in the couch, we bought something. I was excited to be on this adventure, this being a part of something so wholly intimate is saying goodbye to everybody. And I feel that being at the end of somebody's life is just as rich an intimate experience as being there when somebody's life begins.
Amy kept a journal that year. Now, in it, she calls her husband by his full name, Joe White. She uses it kind of like a nickname.
April 28th, 2009. Last night, I booked our flights for Joe White and I to take our trip to Northern California, Oregon, and Washington State. After consulting the Atlas, I'm feeling much more relaxed. Joe White, however, is feeling a little tense because knowing how I vacation, he knows my theories. Vacations are for seeing as much as possible. Vacations often need recovery time. June 8th. Last week was New York City, and we squished in what seemed like 400 miles of walking, and we saw a lot of important things, even if from the outside. We did do the handsome cab ride through Central Park.
I recommend it for a break from all of the walking. December 17th. We got the results of Joe White's CT scan yesterday, and the cancer is stable. No growth, no shrink. May 11th, 2010. We checked into Cedar Point's wheelchair policy because nothing gets between Joe White and a roller coaster. June 5th. Joe White is in very poor health. Chemo, at this point, would be worse than a waste of time. Here we are, caught in this time between what was and what will be, a something we didn't want to deal with until the two ladies from hospice came and handed us a crap ton of pamphlets and booklets and all other kinds of lets, and there we were, smacked in the face with what we often pretended wasn't there. What Joe wanted was to ride in the cockpit of an airplane and be a part of everything great. What he gets is an overwhelming outpouring of love and attention and concern. May 27th. So, when we arrived at our swanky gated hotel, the first news I was greeted with was, "You've been upgraded to the presidential suite." I didn't have to make a single doctor appointment or worry about hemoglobin counts or if Joe White needs another transfusion. We didn't think about that for 4 days in a row. The kids were in complete amazement the entire time. Up until this point, the fanciest place we've ever taken them is the Holiday Inn, and they were in awe. We ate all of our meals together, we went night swimming together, and at the end of the day, we were exhausted together. When the girls get out of school, we're headed up to the UP for some quality time with the lake and the mosquitoes. Right now, life is being good to us. July 4th. Joe White passed away. We didn't make it to the UP that last time. Really, we knew he was too sick to go, but that was okay. We had another adventure in the works. He was 38, and I was 33.
That was Amy Scott talking about her husband, Joe White. Coming up, stopping cancer before it starts.
What we are trying to do is look at those individuals that we know have an increased risk of developing cancer and intervene with those people before they already have cancer.
That story in 15 minutes on Living with Cancer from Michigan Radio. From Michigan Radio, this is Living with Cancer. I'm Rebecca Williams. Every year in Holland, Michigan, a group of runners gets together to raise money for the American Cancer Society. The event is called Strides for Life.
I've always had a, I'd like to call it a love-hate relationship with running, but really it was more hate than love. Oh, I'm running 100 miles this year.
100 miles.
100 miles.
100 miles over 4 days.
The first year I ran just to prove I could do it.
I've done this because I lost my mother and two brothers to cancer.
And now it's just something I have to do every year. It's part of me now.
I'm Michelle Wilson, and oh my gosh, 2007, I was diagnosed with cancer. I stopped treatment in 2009, so 2010, 11, and this is 12 I ran, yeah. I guess as far as a reason, the reason is so, hopefully, this won't have to continue forever.
My name is Ron Siegel. I started in 1984, which was the year after my dad passed from cancer. And this is what my way of honoring his memory, and I had always vowed that if I, even if I had to crawl, I would continue to do it. And I'm proving that this year because I am indeed crawling.
A lot of the people we talked with told us they wanted to do something, anything, to end cancer. Cancer galvanizes us. We can't control the disease in our bodies, but outside of that, it's full-on warfare. Survivors battle the cancer within themselves, and scientists fight at the front lines. Others turn to the courts. They think pollution has made them sick, and they think they know who's to blame. But as Sarah Alvarez found out, the courts are not always the best place to turn. Sarah, what's the case you've been following?
Well, there's a group of people in the Midland area suing Dow Chemical. They're suing because Dow contaminated the Tittabawassee River with dioxin, and they live along the river.
What are they concerned about?
They're concerned because the EPA says dioxin is likely to cause cancer. And there were tests coming back showing pretty high levels of dioxin on these properties. So they sued to get something done about it. But the whole thing has been going on for 9 years.
9 years?
9 years. And that's pretty typical for a big environmental case. I spoke to Kathy Henry, and she's one of the plaintiffs in this case, and she is pretty frustrated by the whole thing.
We just wanted the courts to force Dow to basically buy our house so we could leave, and we couldn't really afford to just pack up and leave on our own.
Henry's group has not been successful in getting Dow to pay for any moves or for medical monitoring to look out for future health problems. And let's just say here that these cases aren't easy for the companies being sued either. They take up a lot of time and resources. Sarah Gossman teaches toxic tort classes at the University of Michigan Law School. She says Kathy Henry's experience is not uncommon.
Toxic tort is a lawsuit for personal injury. These cases are complex, they're difficult to prove, they're very expensive.
Let's say, for example, there's a case where people say a company released a chemical into their water, and now some of them have cancer. Sarah Gossman says it's going to get complicated right away.
I think a lot of the difficulty comes from the lack of scientific knowledge about how people get cancer.
And there's one other thing.
Since cancers don't usually show up for 20 to 30 years after the exposure, you have to reconstruct after a great length of time what actually happened. That is the big issue around toxic torts.
Sometimes the system works for plaintiffs. When it does, they can win a lot of money and really change how companies act. But that doesn't happen often. Sarah Gossman says maybe the courts aren't the best place for these kinds of fights, but that people keep ending up there anyway. Why? Because the laws that should protect people from toxic substances in the first place and keep them out of court are weak.
Right now, the federal laws governing these substances, the main federal law governing it, which is called the Toxic Substances Control Act, TSCA, is widely seen as a failure. It doesn't actually protect people's health.
In fact, that law, it's basically been locked in a drawer. Gossman says the EPA hasn't even tried to use it to regulate any toxic substances at all in more than 20 years. So what are people supposed to do? Well, there are alternatives to the court system, like the 9/11 Health Compensation Act. People who got certain diseases from dust after the Twin Towers collapsed got some money automatically to pay for certain health problems. But that's not happening on a wide scale. So people will still turn to the courts if they think the environment has made them sick. And what advice does Kathy Henry, the woman suing Dow right now, have for those people?
So all you can do is try, but I wish them luck.
So Sarah, we've heard that the courts really didn't work for Kathy Henry, or they haven't yet. But there are big cases where polluters really do get taken to task. I'm sure I'm not the only one who's thinking about Erin Brockovich. Aren't the courts a good place to prove that one chemical or another causes cancer and then to get something done about it?
Sometimes they are. The public can get a lot of information about which chemicals cause disease through the courts. For example, the government was finally able to really prove that smoking causes cancer because they proved it in court. But there's a downside. When the courts are working efficiently, the public is not going to get very much information about chemicals or the diseases they cause from the courts.
Why not?
Well, because when the courts are working efficiently, there's a push to settle. You know, these cases are long. They take up a lot of resources. If a company thinks they're going to lose, so maybe a link is likely to be shown between a chemical they make and a disease, they're going to settle. And when they settle, that settlement might be confidential, meaning we as the public do not have access to that information.
So we're never going to find that out.
Not if the settlement is confidential. And in those cases, even if a plaintiff has hired scientists to demonstrate that a certain chemical causes a certain disease, if the settlement's confidential, the scientific community does not have access to that information, and the public doesn't either.
Okay, so I can see how having a confidential settlement might work for the parties in the case. The plaintiffs get compensated, the defendant can save this, keep this information secure and not have to release it. But what about the rest of us? Don't we have a right to know what chemicals might cause disease?
I think we do. But if we want this information, the courts might not be the best places to settle these types of environmental disputes in the first place.
So is this something that lawmakers are concerned about?
Some of them are. There are these things called Sunshine and Litigation Acts, and that means that a confidential settlement will not be allowed when there is the public health at issue or safety or something else like that. And one of these was introduced last year in the United States Congress, but it didn't really go anywhere. And some states have these laws, too. But Michigan is not one of them.
Okay. Thank you, Sarah.
Sure. Thank you.
There are a lot of things that people with healthy bodies take for granted. Control is one of them. For the most part, we can do what we want. We can go where we want to go. During his treatment for leukemia, Rodney Curtis gave up some of that control.
It's not myin. It must be urine. They monitor my urine here. The total cost of my stay to the insurance company will probably be about $250,000, but to the people that have to dump my collected urine, that cost is far too low. The nurses down here at Carmanis need to know how much my output is keeping pace with my input. So, no toilet for me. It's a series of random jugs, some of them placed bedside in the middle of the night, some elsewhere. I'm the Easter Bunny of pee. The nurses find my hidden treasures, measure them, then dump them. Amazing nurse Melissa was attending to my daily medications and IV drips when she stepped into the bathroom, only to find a few empty jugs. Hmm, she thought. Has Rodney slowed down his output? And here's what she asked. Did somebody dump urine on you today? I think my response was, oh, I didn't realize we were in one of those relationships, you and I. Is laughter the best medicine? For me, it is. So much of cancer recovery and, indeed, any type of healing is how you look at it. I've been told by doctors, nurses, and former patients that attitude counts for everything when it comes to the difference between success and failure. If attitude is everything, why in the name of everything would I be negative? Oh, I know why. Because it's freaking cancer we're talking about here, and cancer is, by its very definition, negative. You don't hear people talking about a gorgeous sunset or a fantastic meal by saying, man, that baked ziti was so creamy and delicious, it's downright cancerous. I've spewed a lot of crazy stuff since I was diagnosed, and if you know me, I was even crazier beforehand, but the one takeaway I've gleaned is to simply push the positive. It's like calisthenics sometimes, making yourself cross over to the sunny side of the street. When the people around me say much of healing is mental, it almost sounds like magical thinking. But I'll try anything. So I force the desperation out of my disposition. But then nighttime shows up. Along with nighttime arrives an insane gut disease, which is so contagious, visitors have to wear paper gowns and rubber gloves when they enter my room. Night also brings Neupogen, shots which explode my bones so the stem cells can settle into my body and bring along their furniture, a couple friends, and even a cardboard box or two of old 8-track tapes they couldn't eBay. And finally, mucositis sneaks on in. It's a mouth and throat disease so painful it feels like I sleptwalked down to a Rouge River foundry, grabbed a Dixie cup full of molten steel, and swallowed it on a bar bet. Through this all, do I remain positive and upbeat? No, man, heck no. Remember the part about the exploding bones? No, this is beyond pain. But as I reach over and grab the weird device that sucks spit out of my mouth, I realize this too shall pass. It's only for now. And that's the key. It will all be over, eventually. Of that, I am positive.
Rodney Curtis is the author of the book Acute Leukemia. You can read more of his work on his blog, spiritualwanderer.com. We've been hearing from all kinds of people who are living with cancer. It's an experience that takes many forms. It's personal after a diagnosis. There are legal struggles after a pattern of cancer is found, and researchers are still trying to unlock the mysteries of how cancers start. Reporter Mark Brush joins us again. And Mark, you visited some doctors who are trying to figure this out.
Yeah, I stopped by the University of Michigan's Comprehensive Cancer Center. It's one of several dozen cancer research centers around the country. And these centers receive a lot of money from the federal government.
What do they spend it on?
A lot of research. You know, their main purpose is to discover new ways of treating cancer. And they also spend a lot of money and resources on figuring out how to stop cancer in the first place. Researchers have come a long way in understanding cancer cells, but there's still a lot to learn. While I was there at the Cancer Research Center, Dr. Madhuri Kakarala had me peek through her microscope.
Just describe for me what you see here, and okay. I'll tell you what it is.
Okay, let's see here. I see like a cluster of white spots.
Right, that looks kind of like a circular ball, right? A three-dimensional circular ball. That is a mammosphere.
Those are stem cells from human breast tissue. Dr. Kakarala says a chemical many of us are exposed to, bisphenol A, can promote cell growth. And they want to learn if it promotes the growth of some kinds of breast cancers. This is just one experiment in this lab, one puzzle. They're also looking at how some spices, like turmeric and pepper, might keep cells from turning cancerous, and how some foods and anti-inflammatory drugs also might help.
What we are trying to do is look at those individuals that we know have an increased risk of developing cancer and intervene with those people before they already have cancer.
Much of what they do here falls under the umbrella term of cancer prevention research. Cancer prevention can be cell biology like this, or it can be developing vaccines. Or it can mean educating the public about the things that can reduce their cancer risk. Things like maintaining a healthy weight, reducing emotional stress, eating the right foods, and exercising. Some cancer rates are rising, but if you look at all cancers combined, the overall rates have been ticking downward since 2001. More people have quit smoking, and that's led to a drop in lung cancer rates. And more people are getting screened, and that's led to a drop in colon cancer rates. There's a big complex puzzle that still remains, though, and that's, can researchers find the things that increase our cancer risk? There are around 80,000 chemicals all around us in our lives today, and only a fraction of those have been well studied. Many health professionals say that more needs to be done, but all this kind of research takes a lot of money. And today, more money is being spent on treating the disease than preventing it. The National Cancer Institute is the biggest funder of research in the U.S., the government agency has an annual budget of more than $5 billion. When we looked at the programs aimed specifically at prevention, we found that only 13% of their 2011 budget went toward this kind of research. When I checked with an NCI official, they said it's actually closer to 27%. Much of the research they fund focuses on basic cell biology, and so that can lead to breakthroughs in treatment and prevention, so it's hard to parse out. Dr. Cacarella says no matter what her funding situation, she'll keep looking for answers. In her first year of medical school, she was diagnosed with an advanced thyroid cancer. She says living through that experience helps her when she's in the lab or when she's with her patients.
It makes me really understand the suffering that they're going through because I've been in that bed. And in the lab, it's a huge motivator. You may or may not get your next grant, but I'm not giving up on this because this is a mission. It's not just a career.
Dr. Cacarella says she feels like her experience drives her to solve these complex genetic puzzles, to learn ways to keep our cells from mutating out of control.
Cancer is more than just one disease. There isn't a universal cause, and there probably won't be a universal cure. Each cancer is like a fingerprint. Those differences are linked to our DNA. But it's not just our genes. Everyone's experience with cancer is different. Those differences can be cultural or personal. For Amy Scott and her husband Joe White, cancer was an opportunity.
Cancer was a gift for us. What he was given was the opportunity to fulfill the dreams that everybody talks about.
Karen Hawk says that having cancer changed her in all kinds of unexpected ways.
Having cancer has made me much more empathetic and concerned about others who are ill. Having cancer has made me feel guilty sometimes because I survived. Sometimes having cancer makes me feel I know I'm stronger because of it.
Everyone's experience with cancer is different. The closer we come to understanding it, the better we can protect ourselves from the things in our environment that can lead to cancer. Living with Cancer was produced by Meg Kramer with assistance from Mercedes Mejia. We had help from Mark Brush and Sarah Alvarez. Tamar Charney was the executive producer. Living with Cancer was informed by the Public Insight Network. I'm Rebecca Williams. This documentary is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan.